I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Former CIA Director Porter Goss on national security, Florida's Republican Party chairman on state gun laws, and a race to Orlando International Airport. We'll hear all that and more as we listen back to Intersection's Best of 2012 interviews. Plus, during this holiday season, parties and family get-togethers, it can be tough. But what makes a good conversation? We'll find out ahead on Intersection. International tensions and national security were hot topics in this year's presidential race, and incidents like Benghazi are keeping those issues in the news. I had the opportunity to speak with Porter Goss in February when he visited Central Florida. Goss served as CIA director from 2004 to 2006. He also served in Congress and was the first mayor of Sanibel, Florida, where he helped establish a newspaper. Goss began the conversation by discussing what he thinks is the biggest threat facing the United States.
The answer is everywhere. We are a global organization at CIA, and we have to have the resources to do the job. We do, I think, a very good job of trying to understand the problem. We don't have enough capability to deal with everything at the same time. It's just not a fact at this point that we have that capability. We're much better than we were, and we need to be better, and we need to commit resources to do it, because the kind of things you're talking about are unconventional warfare. We're not talking about tanks meeting on the plains of Europe anymore, or fleets and armadas shooting each other up in the Straits of Gibraltar.
You're saying the bipolar Cold War world is gone.
That game plan, that military plan, goes back on the shelf. Now we have unconventional warfare. You ask me which are the hottest at the moment. It depends what moment you ask that. I would say you can't take your eye off the ball anywhere. But right now, I'm most worried about nuclear proliferation in the hands of people who are not entirely sane, people who would vaporize themselves for either some kind of a radical ideological belief or because of some ingrained hate that is paramount in their life as opposed to any rational thought about survival. Those are the things that give you nightmares. They're very hard to predict, and they're very hard to know unless you have your ear literally to the ground everywhere. Because even though the material is out there, it's benign until somebody misuses it. It's knowing who's going to misuse it, which is the trick. And finding those people and neutralizing them is really what the actionable intelligence needs to be. And that quite often takes more than just the clandestine service. It takes a marriage between the clandestine service and the United States military to deal with those issues. You saw that with Osama bin Laden. That is not a new thing that happened. That has been a mechanic that we had worked out over the years because we saw the need and we prepared for it. It's a wonderful success story. The part of that story that is unusual about Osama bin Laden is that the president of the United States got up and said, "We did it." He wasn't supposed to do that. That was supposed to just be bump in the night. Something bad happened. Oh, my gosh, Osama bin Laden is dead. We are not supposed to admit that we were over there doing that. You saw what a problem it's caused in Pakistan. It, frankly, is almost like an act of war to send in a war machine to another country that you're not at war at, that with soldiers with American patches or identifiable as American. So, of course, they didn't go in as identifiable as American. They went in with plausible denial. And that program would have been just as wonderful for the United States, would have worked just as well if we had never said we did it. The fact that Osama bin Laden is dead is what's important. It's actually better in a way if you say, "We don't know how it happened," because the other Osama bin Ladens out there are going to worry a lot more. Now they know about our MO, about how we did that. It's a shame we gave that away. We didn't have to do it. The reason we did it was political. It had nothing to do with national security. It was strictly political.
Does neutralize always mean taking somebody out, killing them?
Not at all. My view on Osama bin Laden is I would much rather have him in Guantanamo, which is, frankly, a state-of-the-art detention facility that is very humanitarian, and all this baloney about what a terrible place it is nonsense. Anybody who's been down there and seen it is better than many of our detention centers where we keep American citizens.
And you've been there?
Oh, yeah, of course. And several times for several reasons over the years. Guantanamo is a wonderful asset for our country. It's something that we had to have as a place to put unconventional enemy combatants.
That was former CIA Director Porter Goss. One of Central Florida's biggest stories this year was the shooting death of Trayvon Martin. The unarmed teen was gunned down by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch volunteer. Zimmerman said he shot Martin in self-defense, sparking a nationwide reexamination of the state's Stand Your Ground law. Zimmerman is now charged with second-degree murder, awaiting trial. In April, not long after Trayvon Martin's death, I spoke with Lenny Curry, chairman of Florida's Republican Party. I asked him about the GOP stance on the Stand Your Ground law.
First, let me say that my prayers, condolences go out to Trayvon's family. Tragic. I have young children of my own. I can't even imagine what they've experienced. In terms of the Stand Your Ground law, I'll leave it up to the policymakers and the task force to review it and come to the appropriate conclusion and decision.
Do you think, though, I mean, this issue not going away, we're already seeing it kind of being raised by Democrats like Chris Smith, wanting to have it repealed in the legislative session. Is this something that Republicans are going to be defending when they meet again in Tallahassee?
Look, I'm a Second Amendment guy. I believe that individuals that are constitutional in the United States allows for people to have firearms. As far as how the state, again, the state handles this issue, I'm just going to let the policymakers, the task force, have this conversation, and they'll come to a conclusion, and they'll have to answer to Floridians, to the voters.
Do you think it's going to come up on the national stage when the Republican National Convention moves into Tampa?
The issues that we should be talking about going to this national election are job creation and economic opportunity. We've been successful in Florida here. Governor Scott has in the Florida legislature in creating jobs, creating a business-friendly environment in spite of the federal government. It would be nice to have a partner in the federal government, but that just doesn't exist. So I expect that that's going to be the issue. That's the issue now, and that's what we're going to be focused on and talking about.
Still, though, you'd acknowledge this has definitely touched a nerve.
This has touched a nerve, but there are many other issues that the Democrats want to talk about. Let's even putting aside this, because this is a tragic case. A young man lost his life. But, you know, the Democrats are trying to get off of the subject, off of the conversation. They want to talk about anything but what actually this president has done, and that is he's incurred almost $5 trillion of debt in less than 4 years, about the same amount President Bush incurred over two terms. So they're just trying to come up with other issues to distract from their failures. And that he didn't, instead of focusing on job creation, he focused on a health care law that is now tied up in the Supreme Court. They don't want to talk about that, so they're going to be looking to change the subject and talk about any other number of issues, and we're going to remain focused on what matters to individual Americans, and that's the economy.
That was Florida Republican Party Chairman Lenny Curry speaking earlier this year. Florida lawmakers will likely consider Stand Your Ground this spring when the legislature reconvenes. Nationwide, a broad effort among lawmakers to strengthen gun and ammunition laws is already emerging after the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. The Orlando Magic went through a major shakeup this year. Head coach Stan Van Gundy was ousted in the turmoil over star player Dwight Howard's future. Howard eventually transferred to the L.A. Lakers. I talked with Van Gundy in October about what it's like working with big-name players like Howard and Shaquille O'Neal.
I mean, as a matter of fact, I've always thought that what I've done with the better players is put more demands on them. I mean, you know, the best player, I think, can always look at things two ways. I'm the best, so I'm entitled to special treatment, or I'm the best, so what's required of me is more responsibility. And I've always tried to encourage the latter, that because you're the best, because you're the most talented, you're going to set the tone for our team. So two things. Number one, you've got to understand that and take more responsibility, but you've also got to understand that I'm going to be harder on you than I am on other people. And I think most guys are willing to accept that responsibility.
Is it common that they come into it understanding that they need to separate ego or perception of what they are by the public from what their role is on the team?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. The one thing I've always said about ego with NBA players is I would never want a guy on my team that didn't have a huge ego. Look, if
you don't want someone without
no,
a huge ego.
I mean, look.
You want the ego. You're seeking
absolutely,
it.
Mark, because you've got to think anybody who's going to go out and do their job in front of 20,000 people every night and be subject to that kind of public scrutiny, you better have a very healthy ego. If not, the situation will destroy you. I mean, it'll scare you. You know, oh boy, I don't know if I'm good enough and I'm out here in front of 20,000 people. If you don't go out there thinking you're the best player in the world or better than the guy you're playing against, you've got virtually no chance to be successful. And so I always wanted people with egos. Similarly, I wanted players on my team who wouldn't be happy sitting on the bench. You know, you want the guy to think I'm good enough to play.
Doesn't that just create a handful of management material for you to deal with, though?
To some degree. But the one thing I'll say is I think NBA players are, number one, extremely smart. And number two, for the most part, they're mature. And it's one of the things that has separated them from other very talented players who haven't made it to that level, is they're more mature and they're smarter. And I think they understand, yeah, okay, I've got this big ego. I think I should be playing ahead of whoever the teammate is. But even with that being the case, you know, I've got to do what I can in this role to help the team. Doesn't mean they're going to be happy about it all the time, but that it needs to be done. Occasionally, that's going to create problems, and you have to deal with those things on a daily basis. But I give NBA players and other athletes a great deal of credit because these are extremely talented people, and yet they have to take their egos and subjugate them. It doesn't mean that they don't have them, but they have to subjugate those egos to work with everybody else.
Do you have to get along with a player who has a big ego to make a successful team?
You've got to get along to the, you know, to the level that, you know, it make it a good working relationship. And I think that, but I do think this, I think the players can have coaches that they may not like. They may not like the coach's style. They may not like, you know, everything the coach does. But number one, there's a respect level. And number two, they can still be very successful. They can do what they're supposed to do and be successful. So you have to get along on a professional level. And I think you have to separate the professional and the personal. I was very lucky. I liked all the guys I coached in the NBA. I really did. There wasn't a single guy the entire time I was in the NBA that I didn't like.
That was former Orlando Magic head coach Stan Van Gundy. Another fascinating interview in 2012 happened in February with two Tuskegee Airmen from Florida. The Tuskegee Airmen served as the nation's first black military aviators. They flew combat missions during World War II when the military was still segregated and Jim Crow laws existed in many states. Pilot George Hardy began the conversation by explaining why he joined the Tuskegee Airmen, even though he was a biracial pilot.
My mother was almost all white, and my father still had some white in his background. But basically, the family I grew up with was my father's, and they were basically black. And so they're the people that I live with, grew up with, and love me, and I love them.
So how did you end up being in the Tuskegee Airmen Division, which was identified as kind of a black unit?
Well, because of the fact that during World War II or during the period, the definition of who's white and black was, they call them colored. Because any measure of black, you're colored, say. And so you're part of that group. And they're the group I grew up with, say, and they're the people I felt comfortable with. And so when I applied, I made sure I was applying to go to Tuskegee.
Coming away from World War II, what did you feel were the biggest accomplishments for the Tuskegee Airmen? Was it in the combat skies? Was it back home on the home front advancing racial equality? Where do you think the legacy of the Tuskegee Airmen lies?
In both. We had a presidential unit citation for our mission to Berlin. We managed to destroy a damaged 409 enemy aircraft. 112 were in aerial combat, and we lost 12. Now, for people who were not supposed to be able to fly, that's a 10-to-1 kill ratio. Hey, that wasn't bad. And I think the performance of the Tuskegee Airmen experiment was such that it contributed largely to President Truman's decision to sign Executive Order 9981 to eliminate discrimination in the military.
Georgia, what do you think about that legacy question? Where does it lie?
Well, the thing is that the performance of the Tuskegee Airmen in Europe, Ramatelli was a all-black base, and they were able to do as well as any of the other groups as far as number of airplanes put in the air every day and the missions they flew. And so it meant that the ground crew was also doing their jobs. And so the Air Force became a separate service in September 1947 and was put on a par with the Army and the Navy. And shortly after, within months of being a separate service, they initiated a study, head of personnel of the Air Force, initiated a study on racial integration within the Air Force. And in April 48, the Chief of Staff announced that they were going to move ahead with this thing of equal opportunities, that is racial integration within the Air Force. They didn't give a date for it, but said they were going to move ahead with that. And several months later, President Truman in July issued his executive order. And the Air Force was ready to go with integration. And in July of 49 was the official date, 1st of July, where the outfits at Lockburn were inactivated, the 332nd, and everyone there received orders transferring to Air Force bases all over the world. And that was the start of integration.
That was Tuskegee Airman George Hardy and Leo Gray. Here in Central Florida, there are many types of roads allowing people to move quickly from point A to point B. Factor in a deadline, like getting to a plane on time, and choosing your route takes on a high level of importance. On Intersection, we've been wondering about that question. What's the best route, say, to get to Orlando International Airport? I put it to my colleague Matthew Petty, who reports for Transportation Nation.
So we consider two dominant road systems, toll roads and surface streets, which would be faster to get to the international airport.
We decided to run a little experiment.
We chose to start at City Hall in downtown Orlando on a Thursday morning around 9 a.m. My route would take me onto the 408 heading east, south on the 417, and finally connect to the airport via the beach line.
I would be following surface streets east down Anderson, around Lake Underhill to Conway, and over to the 436 for a straight shot, hopefully, south to the airport.
Both routes timed out at 26 minutes, according to Google Maps.
But my distance was only 12 miles, and Matt would have to cover 21 miles in the same time.
But using only toll roads, I'd avoid the headache of stop-and-go traffic. I'd be driving a 2000 model E-Class Mercedes-Benz sedan, automatic with wood inlay interior.
I'd be cruising in my sporty 2007 Honda Fit stick shift with no wood interior.
So our story begins in front of Orlando's City Hall.
Let's go there now. So with our engines started and our producers rolling tape, we got to it.
I immediately pulled off the line before Mark. And then I got a call.
What are we jumped the gun here?
Yeah, you guys started without us calling 321.
Oh, do you want us to do it again? Should we go around the block and start again?
I don't know, Petty, you cheated. Anyway, you're already in your car. I think that as soon as the light changes, that's go. Okay, 321, go.
Ugh, what do I do?
Yep, you're losing already.
Petty is already lost. He's just lost the race.
The race didn't get off to a great start for me. Distracted by the phone call, I was stranded in the wrong lane and missed my turnoff for the 408.
Matt's misfortune gave me and my producer Amy Green an advantage. At least we were headed in the right direction. But that advantage was short-lived.
All right, so we're en route. We're on South Street. We're already coming to our first red light. Do you think we should check back in and see if he's made it on the highway yet?
It was Simpson again.
No, what happened? Where are you now?
I won't bore you with the details, but we weren't just catching up, we were passing them. As we sped through the E-Pass lanes, effortlessly paying the tolls, the 408 unwound beneath the wheels of the Benz like a glorious ribbon of asphalt, unsullied by traffic lights.
Meanwhile, on the surface streets, it wasn't so idyllic.
Okay. So this is where we're going to win or lose, I think. Because in the time that it takes for us to go and get on Cimarron Boulevard, they're going to be able to travel much farther, much faster. And right now we're stuck behind a city bus. It's a couple of cars ahead of us, and we can already see that our speed is dropping. Mind you, that we are following the lawfully posted speed limit of 35 miles an hour.
We even had to go through a school zone, which further slowed our progress.
As Mark fought his way through traffic, my producer Nicole Kristen and I had already passed the 417 and were headed onto the final stretch of our journey. The beach line.
We're about a mile off the Goldenrod exit. We're about 3¾ miles from Tradeport Drive, and that's getting quite close to the airport. So I would back me right now. If I was a betting man, I would put some money on the Benz.
Oh, man. Matt, I can't talk to you right now. You're stressing me out.
By now, Nicole and I were getting close to our destination.
I think the next time we check in, Matt, we'll be there.
Yes, that sounds good. Well, look, you can see the airport right now.
Me and my producer were close, too.
We're pulling into the airport right now, too. We're on the service road right now.
So, as you can tell, we were neck and neck, but it was becoming readily apparent that the winner would be...
Now, hold it, Simpson. Hold it, Simpson. Before we tell you who won, we did go talk with some professionals about factors that do affect commuting across town in Orlando.
We met up with Chris Sinclair. He's the head of Renaissance Planning Group in Orlando. He teaches a transportation class at Rollins College.
What are the characteristics of taking those two different routes in terms of from a transportation perspective and a planning perspective?
One is fairly seamless. It's convenient. Cost more money, but once you get locked in to the expressway, you're locked in and you don't have to think about too terribly much. Surface streets, you have to contend with the unpredictability of it all, the stop-and-go traffic. 436s can be amazing because you just go flying in between signals, and if they don't have the signals timed properly, you come to a screeching halt.
So there's the pros and cons. We also polled the planning students to see which route they would choose.
It's a whole lot less frustrating for me to get on a toll road. I have an e-pass, and I feel like I'm just shooting straight on through, then I make a right on Conway and go straight on down.
You take a regular service road, you always have to be patient, you have to wait for the light to change, so you have that instant gratification with the toll road.
It's an issue I don't really think about too much. I just take service streets by default. I kind of like to look at people at intersections. It's just something weird that I do. So I just like to look at kind of who's driving alongside me, where I feel like the people on the highway is just competition all the time. So this, I like to know who I'm at least competing against.
That was Jeff Karsh, Jose Carlos Ayala, and Jesse Hugo. And now the answer you've been waiting for.
It was close. The winner only snatched victory by a 2-minute margin.
If we had gotten one more green light, I think we would have won. Well, good job, Matt.
And to mark your success, Matt, I'll let you ring the victory gong. Congratulations.
Thanks, Mark.
That was 90.7's Matthew Petty joining me in November on a race to determine which route is fastest from downtown Orlando to the Orlando International Airport, toll roads or city streets. I have to say it was the toll roads that won, only by a small margin, though. Coming up on Intersection, 90.7's Amy Green leads a conversation about the art of talking.
This is Intersection. I'm Amy Green. It's that time of year when people gather at holiday parties and around dinner tables and make conversation. We here at Intersection have been commemorating the show's 5-year anniversary by looking back at some of our favorite conversations, but we also wanted to examine the art of the conversation itself. What makes a good conversation? We decided to have that conversation with 90.7's Tom Parkinson.
Nice to see you, Amy.
And also, of course, 90.7's Mark Simpson.
Happy to be here.
Thanks, Mark. Mark, you've been the host of Intersection now for 5 years. Tom, you're the host of Morning Edition. You both have interviewed all sorts of newsmakers, political leaders, historic figures, everyday folks who land in the news. People are engaged in holiday events this time of year. What do you think makes a good conversation?
I think just start with the basics. You know, hi, how are you? I think that's your opening gambit. What do you say, Tom?
Well, with many people, that's all it takes, and they will be glad to tell you exactly how they are, which may or may not be a good thing. But in the course of that opening gambit there, you usually elicit from the person something that they're interested in. And, you know, you and I, Mark, have been doing this long enough that I can carry on at least a short conversation about almost anything for I can carry my in for a little while. But it's very much like what we do for a living, interviewing people. A lot of those skills translate, and it comes down to more listening than talking. If you can develop that skill and really listen to what people are saying, they'll guide you.
Well, I think for some people, conversation comes very easily. Some people can just walk up to people and talk to anyone. Other people feel more shy. Do you think that conversation is a talent or a skill?
A little bit of both. I think it's a balance. Obviously, some people have that innate ability, the gift of gab, as they used to call it. But it's also a skill that you can learn. There are volumes of books written about how to interview people and how to carry on a conversation. But I really think it does come back to that basic thing of listening for what people are interested in and what they want to talk about.
For me, it was something that I did have to kind of learn because, in social situations where I don't know anybody, I'll be honest, my tendency is not to go up and just engage with people. But I think it points back to a moment of self-confidence that at these parties, people are there to mingle. They're happy to be there. They're not in a forced situation like they didn't want to be there, except maybe sometimes they are, but we don't want to get into that. But I think if you have the self-confidence to ask those simple questions and just engage, like Tom said, and finding some interest, making a quick connection, people open up and they're always happy to talk about themselves.
People almost always want to talk about what they do. So if you can find a way to say, what do you do? They're very happy to talk to you about that usually. And, generally you can go from there. And if they don't want to talk about that, I'm on holiday, I don't want to talk about work, well, you can find something else. It may be sports, it may be music, it may be books, it may be art. And, it may be politics or religion. I don't necessarily agree that those things are taboo in conversation. And I know that that's something that people often say is to avoid those topics. I don't think so.
As journalists, our job is to ask very direct, hard-hitting questions on those very subjects. Although people often say avoid politics and religion, are there ways to have those discussions
without offending? Those are the most interesting things
offending
to talk about.
I think if you do ask those questions, Tom, I don't think they're out of league to ask, but I think if you do ask, be prepared for a long conversation. Yeah. You could be there for quite a while.
Now, we here at Intersection, we do a lot of research and a lot of preparation for our interviews. And Tom, of course, I know you do the same. What are some interesting conversation topics? What are some things that people can do to have interesting things to talk about? What do people like to talk about?
Well, again, and I keep going back to this, it goes back to it depends on the person. There aren't really any universal themes except, maybe politics and religion. I don't know. Those are, if somebody obviously has very strong opinions about something and it's going to turn into a contentious scene or something, well, then you veer away from that. And, how about those rays?
Mark Simpson, it looks like you have something to say.
Here's the trick. If somebody doesn't want to talk about themselves, you start talking about yourself. And then eventually through what you say about your own life and experiences, they find a connection and they say, that's similar. That reminds me of that. Or they get bored and guess what? They walk away and you find somebody else to talk to.
Well, I've been speaking with 90.7's Mark Simpson and 90.7's Tom Parkinson. Nice speaking with you.
Pleasure, Amy.
Nice to speak to you, too.
Thanks.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.